This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain by Oliver Sacks, read by John Lee. Preface. What an odd thing it is to see an entire species, billions of people, playing with, listening to, meaningless tonal patterns, occupied and preoccupied for much of their time by what they call music. This, at least, was one of the things about human beings that puzzled the highly cerebral alien beings, the overlords, in Arthur C. Clarke's novel Childhood's End. Curiosity brings them down to the Earth's surface to attend a concert. They listen politely, and at the end congratulate the composer on his great ingenuity, while still finding the entire business unintelligible. They cannot think what goes on in human beings when they make or listen to music, because nothing goes on with them. They themselves, as a species, lack music. We may imagine the overlords ruminating further back in their spaceships. This thing called music, they would have to concede, is in some way efficacious to humans, central to human life. Yet it has no concepts, makes no propositions. It lacks images, symbols, the stuff of language. It has no power of representation. It has no necessary relation to the world. There are rare humans who, like the overlords, may lack the neural apparatus for appreciating tones or melodies. But for virtually all of us, music has great power, whether or not we seek it out or think of ourselves as particularly musical. This propensity to music shows itself in infancy, is manifest and central in every culture, and probably goes back to the very beginnings of our species. Such musicophilia is a given in human nature. It may be developed or shaped by the cultures we live in, by the circumstances of life, or by the particular gifts or weaknesses we have as individuals. But it lies so deep in human nature that one must think of it as innate, much as E. O. Wilson regards biophilia, a feeling for living things. Perhaps musicophilia is a form of biophilia, since music itself feels almost like a living thing. Given the obvious similarities between music and language, it is not surprising that there has been a running debate for more than 200 years as to whether they evolved in tandem or independently, and if the latter, which came first. Darwin speculated that musical tones and rhythms were used by our half-human ancestors during the season of courtship, when animals of all kinds are excited not only by love, but by strong passions of jealousy, rivalry, and triumph, and that speech arose, secondarily, from this primal music. His contemporary, Herbert Spencer, held the opposite view, conceiving that music arose from the cadences of emotional speech. Rousseau, a composer no less than a writer, felt that both had emerged together as a sing-song speech and only later diverged. William James saw music as an accidental genesis, a pure incident of having a hearing organ. Steven Pinker, in our own time, has expressed himself even more forcibly. What benefit could there be, he asks, echoing the overlords, to diverting time and energy to making plinking noises? As far as biological cause and effect are concerned, music is useless. It could vanish from our species, and the rest of our lifestyle would be virtually unchanged. There is, nonetheless, much evidence that humans have a music instinct, no less than a language instinct, however this evolved. We humans are a musical species no less than a linguistic one. This takes many different forms. All of us, with very few exceptions, can perceive music, perceive tones, timbre, pitch intervals, melodic contours, harmony, and, perhaps most elementally, rhythm. We integrate all of these and construct music in our minds, using many different parts of the brain. And to this largely unconscious structural appreciation of music is added an often intense and profound emotional reaction to music. The inexpressible depth of music, Schopenhauer wrote, so easy to understand, and yet so inexplicable, is due to the fact that it reproduces all the emotions of our innermost being, but entirely without reality and remote from its pain. Music expresses only the quintessence of life and of its events, never these themselves. Listening to music is not just auditory and emotional, it is motoric as well. We listen to music with our muscles, as Nietzsche wrote. We keep time to music, involuntarily, even if we are not consciously attending to it, and our faces and postures mirror the narrative of the melody, and the thoughts and feelings it provokes. Much that occurs during the perception of music can also occur when music is played in the mind. The imagining of music, even in relatively non-musical people, tends to be remarkably faithful not only to the tune and feeling of the original, but to its pitch and tempo. Underlying this is the extraordinary tenacity of musical memory, so that much of what is heard during one's early years may be engraved on the brain for the rest of one's life. Our auditory systems, our nervous systems, are indeed exquisitely tuned for music. How much this is due to the intrinsic characteristics of music itself, its complex sonic patterns woven in time, its logic, its momentum, its unbreakable sequences, its insistent rhythms and repetitions, the mysterious way in which it embodies emotion and will, and how much to special resonances, synchronizations, oscillations, mutual excitations, or feedbacks in the immensely complex, multi-level neural circuitry that underlies musical perception and replay, we do not yet know. But this wonderful machinery, perhaps because it is so complex and highly developed, is vulnerable to various distortions, excesses, and breakdowns. The power to perceive or imagine music may be impaired with some brain lesions. There are many such forms of amusia. On the other hand, musical imagery may become excessive and uncontrollable, leading to incessant repetition of catchy tunes, or even musical hallucinations. In some people, music can provoke seizures. There are special neurological hazards, disorders of skill, that may affect professional musicians. The normal association of intellectual and emotional may break down in some circumstances, so that one may perceive music accurately, but remain indifferent and unmoved by it, or, conversely, be passionately moved, despite being unable to make any sense of what one is hearing. Some people, a surprisingly large number, see color or taste or smell or feel various sensations as they listen to music, though such synesthesia may be accounted a gift more than a symptom. William James referred to our susceptibility to music, and while music can affect all of us, calm us, animate us, comfort us, thrill us, or serve to organize and synchronize us at work or play, it may be especially powerful and have great therapeutic potential for patients with a variety of neurological conditions. Such people may respond powerfully and specifically to music, and sometimes to little else. Some of these patients have widespread cortical problems, whether from strokes or Alzheimer's or other causes of dementia. Others have specific cortical syndromes, loss of language or movement functions, amnesias or frontal lobe syndromes. Some are retarded, some autistic. Others have subcortical syndromes, such as Parkinsonism or other movement disorders. All of these conditions and many others can potentially respond to music and music therapy. For me, the first incitement to think and write about music came in 1966, when I saw the profound effects of music on the deeply Parkinsonian patients I later wrote about in Awakenings. And since then, in more ways than I could possibly imagine, I have found music continually forcing itself on my attention. showing me its effects on almost every aspect of brain function and life. Music has always been one of the first things I look up in the index of any new neurology or physiology textbook. But I could find scarcely any mention of the subject until the 1977 publication of MacDonald Critchley and R.A. Henson's book, Music and the Brain, with its wealth of historical and clinical examples. Perhaps one reason for the scarcity of musical case histories is that physicians rarely ask their patients about mishaps of musical perception, whereas a linguistic problem, say, will immediately come to light. Another reason for this neglect is that neurologists like to explain, to find putative mechanisms, as well as to describe, and there was virtually no neuroscience of music prior to the 1980s. This has all changed in the last two decades with new technologies that allow us to see the living brain as people listen to, imagine, and even compose music. There is now an enormous and rapidly growing body of work on the neural underpinnings of musical perception and imagery, and the complex and often bizarre disorders to which these are prone. These new insights of neuroscience are exciting beyond measure. But there is always a certain danger that the simple art of observation may be lost, that clinical description may become perfunctory and the richness of the human context ignored. Clearly, both approaches are necessary, blending old-fashioned observation and description with the latest in technology, and I have tried to incorporate both of these approaches here. But above all, I have tried to listen to my patients and subjects, to imagine and enter their experiences. It is these which form the core of this book. Part 1. Haunted by Music. Chapter 1. A Bolt from the Blue. Sudden Musicophilia. Tony Sicoria was 42, very fit and robust, a former college football player who had become a well-regarded orthopedic surgeon in a small city in upstate New York. He was at a lakeside pavilion for a family gathering one fall afternoon. It was pleasant and breezy, but he noticed a few storm clouds in the distance. It looked like rain. He went to a payphone outside the pavilion to make a quick call to his mother. This was in 1994, before the age of cell phones. He still remembers every single second of what happened next. I was talking to my mother on the phone. There was a little bit of rain, thunder in the distance. My mother hung up. The phone was a foot away from where I was standing when I got struck. I remember a flash of light coming out of the phone. It hit me in the face. Next thing I remember, I was flying backwards. Then, he seemed to hesitate before telling me this, I was flying forwards. Bewildered, I looked around. I saw my own body on the ground. I said to myself, "Oh, shit, I'm dead." I saw people converging on the body. I saw a woman. She had been standing waiting to use the phone right behind me, position herself over my body, give it CPR. I floated up the stairs. My consciousness came with me. I saw my kids, had the realization that they would be okay. Then I was surrounded by a bluish-white light, an enormous feeling of well-being and peace. The highest and lowest points of my life raced by me. No emotion associated with these. Pure thought. Pure ecstasy. I had the perception of accelerating, being drawn up. There was speed and direction. Then, as I was saying to myself, "This is the most glorious feeling I have ever had." Slam! I was back. Dr. Sicoria knew he was back in his own body because he had pain. Pain from the burns on his face and his left foot, where the electrical charge had entered and exited his body. And, he realized, only bodies have pain. He wanted to go back. He wanted to tell the woman to stop giving him CPR, to let him go. But it was too late. He was firmly back among the living. After a minute or two, when he could speak, he said, "It's okay. I'm a doctor." The woman, she turned out to be an intensive care unit nurse, replied, A few minutes ago you weren't. The police came and wanted to call an ambulance, but Sikoria refused, delirious. They took him home instead. It seemed to take hours. Where he called his own doctor, a cardiologist. The cardiologist, when he saw him, thought Sikoria must have had a brief cardiac arrest, but could find nothing amiss with examination or EKG. With these things, you're alive or dead, the cardiologist remarked. He did not feel that Dr. Sikoria would suffer any further consequences of this bizarre accident. Sikoria also consulted a neurologist. He was feeling sluggish, most unusual for him, and having some difficulties with his memory. He found himself forgetting the names of people he knew well. He was examined neurologically, had an EEG and an MRI. Again, nothing seemed amiss. A couple of weeks later, when his energy returned, Dr. Sikoria went back to work. There were still some lingering memory problems. He occasionally forgot the names of rare diseases or surgical procedures, but all his surgical skills were unimpaired. In another 2 weeks, his memory problems disappeared, and that, he thought, was the end of the matter. What then happened still fills Sikoria with amazement, even now, a dozen years later. Life had returned to normal, seemingly, when, suddenly, over 2 or 3 days, there was this insatiable desire to listen to piano music. This was completely out of keeping with anything in his past. He had had a few piano lessons as a boy, he said, but no real interest. He did not have a piano in his house. What music he did listen to tended to be rock music. With this sudden onset of craving for piano music, he began to buy recordings and became especially enamored of a Vladimir Ashkenazy recording of Chopin favorites, the Military Polonaise, the Winter Wind Etude, the Black Key Etude, the A-flat Polonaise, the B-flat minor scherzo. I loved them all, Sikoria said. I had the desire to play them. I ordered all the sheet music. At this point, one of our babysitters asked if she could store her piano in our house. So now, just when I craved one, a piano arrived, a nice little upright. It suited me fine. I could hardly read the music, could barely play, but I started to teach myself. It had been more than 30 years since the few piano lessons of his boyhood, and his fingers seemed stiff and awkward. And then, on the heels of this sudden desire for piano music, Sikoria started to hear music in his head. The first time, he said, it was in a dream. I was in a tux on stage. I was playing something I had written. I woke up startled, and the music was still in my head. I jumped out of bed, started trying to write down as much of it as I could remember, but I hardly knew how to notate what I heard. This was not too successful. He had never tried to write or notate music before. But whenever he sat down at the piano to work on the Chopin, his own music would come and take me over. It had a very powerful presence. I was not quite sure what to make of this peremptory music, which would intrude almost irresistibly and overwhelm him. Was he having musical hallucinations? No, Dr. Sikoria said. They were not hallucinations. Inspiration was a more apt word. The music was there, deep inside him, or somewhere, and all he had to do was let it come to him. It's like a frequency, a radio band. If I open myself up, it comes. I want to say it comes from heaven, as Mozart said. His music is ceaseless. It never runs dry, he continued. If anything, I have to turn it off. Now he had to wrestle, not just with learning to play the Chopin, but to give form to the music continually running in his head, to try it out on the piano, to get it on manuscript paper. It was a terrible struggle, he said. I would get up at 4 in the morning and play till I went to work, and when I got home from work, I was at the piano all evening. My wife was not really pleased. I was possessed. In the 3rd month after being struck by lightning, then, Sikoria, once an easygoing, genial family man, almost indifferent to music, was inspired, even possessed by music, and scarcely had time for anything else. It began to dawn on him that perhaps he had been saved for a special reason. I came to think, he said, that the only reason I had been allowed to survive was the music. I asked him whether he had been a religious man before the lightning. He had been raised Catholic, he said, but had never been particularly observant. He had some unorthodox beliefs, too, such as in reincarnation. He himself, he grew to think, had had a sort of reincarnation, had been transformed and given a special gift, a mission, to tune in to the music that he called, half metaphorically, the music from heaven. This came, often, in an absolute torrent of notes with no breaks, no rests between them, and he would have to give it shape and form. As he said this, I thought of Cædmon, the 7th-century Anglo-Saxon poet, an illiterate goatherd who, it was said, had received the art of song in a dream one night, and spent the rest of his life praising God and creation in hymns and poems. Sikoria continued to work on his piano playing and his compositions. He got books on notation, and soon realized that he needed a music teacher. He would travel to concerts by his favorite performers, but had nothing to do with musical friends in his own town or musical activities there. This was a solitary pursuit between himself and his muse. I asked whether he had experienced other changes since the lightning strike. A new appreciation of art, perhaps. Different taste in reading. New beliefs. Sikoria said he had become very spiritual since his near-death experience. He had started to read every book he could find about near-death experiences and about lightning strikes, and he had got a whole library on Tesla, as well as anything on the terrible and beautiful power of high-voltage electricity. He felt he could sometimes see auras of light or energy around people's bodies. He had never seen this before the lightning bolt. Some years passed, and Sikoria's new life, his inspiration, never deserted him for a moment. He continued to work full-time as a surgeon, but his heart and mind now centered on music. He got divorced in 2004, and the same year had a fearful motorcycle accident. He had no memory of this, but his Harley was struck by another vehicle, and he was found in a ditch, unconscious and badly injured, with broken bones, a ruptured spleen, a perforated lung, cardiac contusions, and, despite his helmet, head injuries. In spite of all this, he made a complete recovery and was back at work in 2 months. Neither the accident nor his head injury nor his divorce seemed to have made any difference to his passion for playing and composing music. I have never met another person with a story like Tony Sikoria's, but I have occasionally had patients with a similar sudden onset of musical or artistic interests, including Salima M., a research chemist. In her early 40s, Salima started to have brief periods, lasting a minute or less, in which she would get a strange feeling, sometimes a sense that she was on a beach that she had once known, while at the same time being perfectly conscious of her current surroundings and able to continue a conversation or drive a car or do whatever she had been doing. Occasionally, these episodes were accompanied by a sour taste in the mouth. She noticed these strange occurrences, but did not think of them as having any neurological significance. It was only when she had a grand mal seizure in the summer of 2003 that she went to a neurologist and was given brain scans, which revealed a large tumor in her right temporal lobe. This had been the cause of her strange episodes, which were now realized to be temporal lobe seizures. The tumor, her doctors felt, was malignant, though it was probably an oligodendroglioma of relatively low malignancy, and needed to be removed. Salima wondered if she had been given a death sentence, and was fearful of the operation and its possible consequences. She and her husband had been told that there might be some personality changes following it, but in the event, the surgery went well, most of the tumor was removed, and after a period of convalescence, Salima was able to return to her work as a chemist. She had been a fairly reserved woman before the surgery, who would occasionally be annoyed or preoccupied by small things like dust or untidiness. Her husband said she was sometimes obsessive about jobs that needed to be done around the house. But now, after the surgery, Salima seemed unperturbed by such domestic matters. She had become, in the idiosyncratic words of her husband, English was not their first language, a happy cat. She was, he declared, a joyologist. Salima's new cheerfulness was apparent at work. She had worked in the same laboratory for 15 years and had always been admired for her intelligence and dedication. But now, while losing none of this professional competence, she seemed a much warmer person, keenly sympathetic and interested in the lives and feelings of her co-workers. Where before, in a colleague's words, she had been much more into herself, she now became the confidant and social center of the entire lab. At home, too, she shared some of her Marie Curie-like work-oriented personality. She permitted herself time off from her thinking, her equations, and became more interested in going to movies or parties, living it up a bit. And a new love, a new passion entered her life. She had been vaguely musical, in her own words, as a girl, had played the piano a little, but music had never played any great part in her life. Now it was different. She longed to hear music, to go to concerts, to listen to classical music on the radio or on CDs. She could be moved to rapture or tears by music which had carried no special feeling for her before. She became addicted to her car radio, which she would listen to while driving to work. A colleague who happened to pass her on the road to the lab said that the music on her radio was incredibly loud. He could hear it a quarter of a mile away. Salima, in her convertible, was entertaining the whole freeway. Like Tony Sicoria, Salima showed a drastic transformation from being only vaguely interested in music to being passionately excited by music and in continual need of it. And with both of them, there were other more general changes too, a surge of emotionality, as if emotions of every sort were being stimulated or released. In Salima's words, what happened after the surgery? I felt reborn. That changed my outlook on life and made me appreciate every minute of it. Could someone develop a pure musicophilia without any accompanying changes in personality or behavior? In 2006, just such a situation was described by Rora, Smith, and Warren in their striking case history of a woman in her mid-60s who had intractable temporal lobe seizures with a right temporal lobe focus. After 7 years of seizure activity, her seizures were finally brought under control by the anticonvulsant drug Lamotrigine, LTG. Prior to starting on this medication, Rora and his colleagues wrote, "This lady had always been indifferent to music, never listening to music for pleasure or attending concerts. This was in contrast to her husband and daughter, who played the piano and violin. She was unmoved by the traditional Thai music she had heard at family and public events in Bangkok, and by classical and popular genres of Western music after she moved to the United Kingdom. Indeed, she continued to avoid music where possible, and actively disliked certain musical timbres. For example, she would shut the door to avoid hearing her husband playing piano music, and found choral singing irritating. This indifference to music changed abruptly when the patient was put on Lamotrigine. Within several weeks of starting LTG, a profound change was noted in her appreciation of music. She sought out musical programs on the radio and television, listened to classical music stations on the radio for many hours each day, and demanded to attend concerts. Her husband described how she had sat transfixed throughout La Traviata and became annoyed when other audience members talked during the performance. She now described listening to classical music as an extremely pleasant and emotion-charged experience. She did not sing or whistle, and no other changes were found in her behavior or personality. No evidence of thought disorder, hallucinations, or disturbed mood was seen. While Rora et al. Could not pinpoint the precise basis of their patient's musicophilia, they hazarded the suggestion that during her years of incorrigible seizure activity, she might have developed an intensified functional connection between perceptual systems in the temporal lobes and parts of the limbic system involved in emotional response, a connection that only became apparent when her seizures were brought under control with medication. In the 1970s, David Baer suggested that such a sensory-limbic hyperconnection might be the basis for the emergence of the unexpected artistic, sexual, mystical, or religious feelings that sometimes occur in people with temporal lobe epilepsy. Could something similar have occurred with Tony Sicoria, too? Last spring, Sicoria took part in a 10-day music retreat for student musicians, gifted amateurs, and young professionals. The camp doubles as a showroom for Erika Vanderlinde Feidner, a concert pianist who also specializes in finding the perfect piano for each of her clients. Tony had just bought one of her pianos, a Bussendorfer Grand, a unique prototype made in Vienna. She thought he had a remarkable instinct for picking out a piano with exactly the tone he wanted. It was, Sicoria felt, a good time, a good place to make his debut as a musician. He prepared two pieces for his concert. His first love, Chopin's B-flat minor scherzo, and his own first composition, which he called Rhapsody, Opus 1. His playing and his story electrified everyone at the retreat. Many expressed the fantasy that they, too, might be struck by lightning. He played, said Erika, with great passion, great brio, and if not with supernatural genius, at least with creditable skill, an astounding feat for someone with virtually no musical background who had taught himself to play at 42. What did I think, in the end, of his story? Dr. Sicoria asked me. Had I ever encountered anything similar? I asked him what he thought, and how he would interpret what had happened to him. He replied that, as a medical man, he was at a loss to explain these events, and he had to think of them in spiritual terms now. I countered that, with no disrespect to the spiritual, I felt that even the most exalted states of mind, the most astounding transformations, must have some physical basis, or at least some physiological correlate in neural activity. At the time of his lightning strike, Dr. Sicoria had both a near-death experience and an out-of-body experience. Many supernatural or mystical explanations have arisen to explain out-of-body experiences, but they have also been a topic of neurological investigation for a century or more. Such experiences seem to be relatively stereotyped in format. One seems to be no longer in one's own body, but outside it, and most commonly, looking down on oneself from 8 or 9 feet above. Neurologists refer to this as autoscopy. One seems to see clearly the room or space around one, and other people and objects nearby, but with an aerial perspective. People who have had such experiences often describe vestibular sensations like floating or flying in the air. Out-of-body experiences can inspire fear or joy or a feeling of detachment, but they are usually described as intensely real, not at all like a dream or hallucination. They have been reported in many sorts of near-death experiences, as well as in temporal lobe seizures. There is some evidence that both the visuospatial and vestibular aspects of out-of-body experiences are related to disturbed function in the cerebral cortex, especially at the junctional region between the temporal and parietal lobes. But it was not just an out-of-body experience that Dr. Sicoria reported. He saw a bluish-white light. He saw his children. His life flashed past him. He had a sense of ecstasy. And above all, he had a sense of something transcendental and enormously significant. What could be the neural basis of this? Similar near-death experiences have often been described by people who have been or believed themselves to be in great danger, whether they are involved in sudden accidents, struck by lightning, or, most commonly, revived after a cardiac arrest. All of these are situations not only fraught with terror, but likely to cause a sudden drop in blood pressure and cerebral blood flow, and if there is cardiac arrest, a deprivation of oxygen to the brain. There is likely to be intense emotional arousal and a surge of noradrenaline and other neurotransmitters in such states, whether the affect is one of terror or rapture. We have, as yet, little idea of the actual neural correlates of such experiences, but the alterations of consciousness and emotion that occur are very profound and must involve the emotional parts of the brain, the amygdala and brainstem nuclei, as well as the cortex. While out-of-body experiences have the character of a perceptual illusion, albeit a complex and singular one, near-death experiences have all the hallmarks of mystical experience, as William James defines them: passivity, ineffability, transience, and a noetic quality. One is totally consumed by a near-death experience, swept up almost literally in a blaze, sometimes a tunnel or funnel of light, and drawn towards a beyond, beyond life, beyond space and time. There is a sense of a last look, a greatly accelerated farewell to things earthly, the places and people and events of one's life, and a sense of ecstasy or joy as one soars towards one's destination, an archetypal symbolism of death and transfiguration. Experiences like this are not easily dismissed by those who have been through them, and they may sometimes lead to a conversion or metanoia, a change of mind, that alters the direction and orientation of a life. One cannot suppose, any more than one can with out-of-body experiences, that such events are pure fancy. Very similar features are emphasized in every account. Near-death experiences must also have a neurological basis of their own, one which profoundly alters consciousness itself. What about Dr. Sikoria's remarkable access of musicality, his sudden musicophilia? Patients with degeneration of the front parts of the brain, so-called frontotemporal dementia, sometimes develop a startling emergence or release of musical talents and passions as they lose the powers of abstraction and language. But clearly this was not the case with Dr. Sikoria, who was articulate and highly competent in every way. In 1984, Daniel Giacomi described a patient who had had a stroke damaging the left hemisphere of his brain, and consequently developed hypermusia and musicophilia, along with aphasia and other problems. But there was nothing to suggest that Tony Sikoria had had a stroke or experienced any significant brain damage, other than a very transient disturbance to his memory systems for a week or two after the lightning strike. His situation did remind me a bit of Franco Magnani, the memory artist of whom I have written. Franco's story is related in The Landscape of His Dreams, a chapter in An Anthropologist on Mars. Franco had never thought of being a painter until he experienced a strange crisis or illness, perhaps a form of temporal lobe epilepsy, when he was 31. He had nightly dreams of Pontito, the little Tuscan village where he was born. After he woke, these images remained intensely vivid, with a full depth and reality, like holograms. Franco was consumed by a need to make these images real, to paint them, and so he taught himself to paint, devoting every free minute to producing hundreds of views of Pontito. Could Dr. Sikoria's lightning strike have set off epileptic tendencies in his temporal lobes? There are many accounts of the onset of musical or artistic inclinations with temporal lobe seizures, and people with such seizures may also develop strong mystical or religious feelings, as he had. But then Sikoria had not described anything resembling seizures, and had apparently had a normal EEG following the event. And why was there such a delay in the development of Sikoria's musicophilia? What was happening in the 6 or 7 weeks that elapsed between his cardiac arrest and the rather sudden eruption of musicality? We know that there were immediate after-effects of the lightning strike: his out-of-body experience, his near-death experience, the confusional state that ensued for a few hours, and the disturbance of memory that lasted a couple of weeks. These could have been due to cerebral anoxia alone, for his brain must have been without adequate oxygen for a minute or more, though there could also have been direct cerebral effects from the lightning itself. One has to suspect, however, that Dr. Sikoria's apparent recovery a couple of weeks after these events was not as complete as it seemed, that there were other, unnoticed forms of brain damage, and that his brain was still reacting to the original insult and reorganizing itself during this time. Dr. Sikoria feels that he is a different person now, musically, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. This was my impression, too, as I listened to his story and saw something of the new passions which had transformed him. Looking at him from a neurological vantage point, I felt that his brain must be very different now from what it was before his lightning strike, or in the days immediately following this, when neurological tests showed nothing grossly amiss. Changes were presumably occurring in the weeks afterwards, when his brain was reorganizing, preparing, as it were, for musicophilia. Could we now, a dozen years later, define these changes, define the neurological basis of his musicophilia? Many new and far subtler tests of brain function have been developed since Sikoria had his injury in 1994, and he agreed that it would be interesting to investigate this further. But after a moment, he reconsidered, and said that perhaps it was best to let things be. His was a lucky strike, and the music, however it had come, was a blessing, a grace, not to be questioned. Chapter 2. A Strangely Familiar Feeling. Musical Seizures. John S., a robust man of 45, had been in perfect health until January of 2006. His working week had just started. He was in the office on a Monday morning and went to get something from the closet. Once he entered the closet, he suddenly heard music. Classical, melodic, quite nice, soothing, vaguely familiar. It was a string instrument, a solo violin. He immediately thought, where the hell is that music coming from? There was an old discarded electronic device in the closet, but this, though it had knobs, had no speakers. Confusedly, in a state of what he later called suspended animation, he groped for the controls of the device to turn the music off. Then, he says, I went out. A colleague in the office who saw all this described Mr. S. as slumped over, unresponsive, in the closet, though not convulsing. Mr. S.'s next memory was of an emergency medical technician leaning over him, questioning him. He could not remember the date, but he remembered his name. He was taken to the emergency room of a local hospital where he had another episode. I was lying down. The doctor was checking me over. My wife was there. Then I started to hear music again, and I said, it's happening again. And then, very quickly, I was out of it. He woke up in another room, where he realized he had bitten his tongue and cheeks and had intense pain in his legs. They told me I had had a seizure, the full thing, with convulsions. It all occurred much quicker than the first time. Mr. S. had some tests and was put on an anti-epileptic drug to protect him against further seizures. Since then, he has had more tests, none of which showed anything amiss, a situation not uncommon with temporal lobe epilepsy. Though no demonstrable lesion showed up on brain imaging, he mentioned that he had suffered a fairly severe head injury at the age of 15, a concussion at least, and this may have produced slight scarring in the temporal lobes. When I asked him to describe the music he heard just before his seizures, he tried to sing it, but could not. He said he could not sing any music, even if he knew it well. He said he was not too musical in any case, and that the sort of classical violin music he had heard before his seizure was not at all to his taste. It sounded whiny, cat-like. Usually he listens to pop music, yet it seemed familiar somehow. Perhaps he had heard it long ago, as a child. I told him that if he ever did hear this music, on the radio perhaps, he should note what it was and let me know. Mr. S. said that he would keep his ears open, but as we talked about it, he could not help wondering whether there was just a feeling, perhaps an illusion of familiarity attached to the music, rather than an actual recollection of something he had once heard. There was something evocative about it, but elusive, like the music heard in dreams. And there we left it. I wonder whether I will get a call from Mr. S. one day, saying, "I just heard it on the radio. It was a Bach suite for unaccompanied violin," or whether what he heard was a dreamlike construction or conflation, which, for all its familiarity, he will never identify. Hewlings Jackson, writing in the 1870s, remarked upon the feeling of familiarity that is so often a feature of the aura which may precede a temporal lobe seizure. He spoke, too, of dreamy states, déjà vu, and reminiscence. Such feelings of reminiscence, Jackson noted, may have no identifiable content whatever. Although some people lose consciousness during a seizure, others may remain perfectly aware of their surroundings, yet also enter an odd, superimposed state in which they experience strange moods or feelings or visions or smells, or music. Hewlings Jackson referred to this situation as a doubling of consciousness. Eric Markowitz, a young musician and teacher, developed in his left temporal lobe an astrocytoma, a tumor of relatively low malignancy, which was operated on in 1993. It recurred 10 years later, but was then considered inoperable due to its proximity to the speech areas of the temporal lobe. With the regrowth of his tumor, he has had repeated seizures, in which he does not lose consciousness, but, as he wrote to me, "Music explodes in my head for about 2 minutes. I love music. I've made my career around it. So it seems a bit ironic that music has also become my tormentor." Eric's seizures are not triggered by music, he emphasized, but music is invariably a part of them. As with John S., Eric's hallucinatory music seems very real to him, and hauntingly familiar. While I am unable to state exactly what song or songs I may be hearing during these aural seizures, I know they seem quite familiar to me, so familiar, in fact, that I am sometimes uncertain whether or not these songs are on a nearby stereo or in my brain. Once I become aware of that strange yet familiar confusion and realize it is in fact a seizure, I seem to try not to figure out what the music may be. Indeed, if I could study it closely like a poem or a piece of music, I would. But perhaps subconsciously I am afraid that if I pay too much attention to it, I may not be able to escape the song, like quicksand or hypnosis. Though Eric, unlike John S., is quite musical, with an excellent musical memory and a highly trained ear, and though he has had more than a dozen such seizures, he is, like Mr. S., completely unable to recognize his aural music. In the strange yet familiar confusion which is an integral part of his seizure experience, Eric finds it difficult to think straight. His wife or friends, if they are present, may notice a strange look on his face. If he has a seizure while at work, he is usually able to wing it somehow, without his students realizing that anything is amiss. There is a fundamental difference, Eric brings out, between his normal musical imagery and that of his seizures. As a songwriter, I'm familiar with how melody and words seem to arrive out of nowhere. This is intentional, though. I sit with my guitar in the attic and work on completion of the song. My seizures, though, are beyond all this. He went on to say that his epileptic music, seemingly contextless and meaningless, though hauntingly familiar, seemed to exert a frightening and almost dangerous spell on him, so that he was drawn deeper and deeper into it. And yet, he has also been so creatively stimulated by these musical auras that he has composed music inspired by them, trying to embody, or at least suggest, their mysterious and ineffable strange but familiar quality. Chapter 3. Fear of Music. Musicogenic Epilepsy. In 1937, MacDonald Critchley, a superb observer of unusual neurological syndromes, described 11 patients he had seen with epileptic seizures induced by music, as well as extending his survey to cases reported by others. He entitled his pioneer article Musicogenic Epilepsy, though he indicated that he preferred the shorter and sweeter term, musicolepsia. Some of Critchley's patients were musical, some were not. The type of music that could provoke their seizures varied a good deal from patient to patient. One specified classical music, another old-time or reminiscent melodies, while a third patient found that a well-punctuated rhythm was for her the most dangerous feature in music. One of my own correspondents had seizures only in response to modern dissonant music, never in response to classical or romantic music. Her husband, unfortunately, was partial to modern dissonant music. Critchley observed how some patients responded only to particular instruments or noises. One such patient reacted only to deep notes from a brass wind instrument. This man was a radio operator on a large ocean liner, but, continually convulsed by the sounds of its orchestra, had to transfer to a smaller ship with no orchestra. Some patients responded only to particular melodies or songs. The most striking case of all was that of an eminent 19th-century music critic, Nikonov, who had his first seizure at a performance of Meyerbeer's opera The Prophet. Thereafter, he became more and more sensitive to music, until finally almost any music, however soft, would send him into convulsions. The most noxious of all, remarked Critchley, was the so-called musical background of Wagner, which afforded an unrelieved and inescapable sound procession. Finally, Nikonov, though so knowledgeable and passionate about music, had to relinquish his profession and avoid all contact with music. If he heard a brass band in the street, he would stop his ears and rush for the nearest doorway or side street. He developed a veritable phobia, a horror of music, and this he described in a pamphlet he titled Fear of Music. Critchley had also published papers a few years earlier on seizures induced by non-musical sounds, usually sounds of a monotonous type, such as a kettle on the boil, an airplane in flight, or machinery in a workshop. In some cases of musicogenic epilepsy, he thought, the particular quality of sound was all important, as with the radio operator who could not tolerate the deep brass. But in others, the emotional impact of the music, and perhaps its associations, seemed more important. The types of seizure that might be provoked by music were quite varied too. Some patients would have major convulsions, fall down unconscious, bite their tongues, be incontinent. Others would have minor seizures, brief absences their friends might hardly notice. Many patients would have a complex temporal lobe type of seizure, as did one of Critchley's patients, who said, I have the feeling that I have been through it all before, as if I were going through a scene. It is the same on each occasion. People are there, dancing. I believe I am on a boat. The scene is not connected with any real place or event which I can recall. Musicogenic epilepsy is generally considered to be very rare, but Critchley wondered if it might be notably more common than supposed. Many people, he thought, might start to get a queer feeling, disturbing, perhaps frightening, when they heard certain music, but then would immediately retreat from the music, turn it off or block their ears, so that they did not progress to a full-blown seizure. He wondered, therefore, if abortive forms, formes frustes, of musical epilepsy might be relatively common. This has certainly been my own impression, and I think there may also be similar formes frustes of photic epilepsy, when blinking lights or fluorescent lights may produce a peculiar discomfort without inducing a full-blown seizure. Working in an epilepsy clinic, I have seen a number of patients with seizures induced by music, and others who have musical auras associated with seizures, and occasionally both. Both types of patient are prone to temporal lobe seizures, and most have temporal lobe abnormalities identifiable with EEG or brain imaging. Among the patients I have seen recently is G.G., a young man who was in good health until June of 2005, when he had a severe attack of herpes encephalitis that started with a high fever and generalized seizures. This was followed by a coma and then a severe amnesia. Remarkably, a year later, His amnesic problems had virtually cleared, but he remained highly seizure-prone, with occasional grand mal seizures and, much more commonly, complex partial seizures. Initially, all of these were spontaneous, but within a few weeks they started to occur almost exclusively in response to sound, sudden loud sounds like ambulance sirens, and, especially, music. Along with this, G.G. developed a remarkable sensitivity to sound, becoming able to detect sounds too soft or distant for others to hear. He enjoyed this and felt that his auditory world was more alive, more vivid, but wondered, too, whether it played any part in his now epileptic sensitivity to music and sound. G.G.'s seizures may be provoked by a large range of music, from rock to classical. The first time I saw him, he played a Verdi aria on his cell phone. After about half a minute, this induced a complex partial seizure. He speaks of romantic music as being the most provocative, especially Frank Sinatra's songs. He touches a chord in me. He says that the music has to be full of emotions, associations, nostalgia. It is almost always music he has known from childhood or adolescence. It does not have to be loud to provoke a seizure. Soft music may be equally effective, but he is in particular trouble in a noisy, music-permeated environment, so much so that he must wear earplugs most of the time. His seizures start with or are preceded by a special state of intense, involuntary, almost forced attention or listening. In this already altered state, the music seems to grow more intense, to swell, to take possession of him, and at this point he cannot stop the process, cannot turn off the music or walk away from it. Beyond this point, he retains no consciousness or memory, though various epileptic automatisms, like gasping and lip-smacking, ensue. For G.G., music does not just provoke a seizure. It seems to constitute an essential part of the seizure, spreading, one imagines, from its initial perceptual locus to other temporal lobe systems, and occasionally to the motor cortex, as when he has generalized seizures. It is as if at such times the provocative music is itself transformed, becoming first an overwhelming psychic experience and then a seizure. Another patient, Sylvia N., came to see me towards the end of 2005. Mrs. N. had developed a seizure disorder in her early 30s. Some of her seizures were of grand mal type, with convulsions and a total loss of consciousness. Others were of a more complex type, in which there would be some doubling of consciousness. Sometimes her seizures seemed to be spontaneous or a reaction to stress, but most often they occurred in response to music. One day, she was found unconscious on the floor, having had a convulsion. Her last memory before this was of listening to a CD of her favorite Neapolitan songs. No significance was ascribed to this at first, but when she had a similar seizure soon afterwards, also during the playing of Neapolitan songs, she started to wonder whether there could be a connection. She tested herself, cautiously, and found that listening to such songs, either live or on a recording, would now infallibly arouse a peculiar feeling, followed quickly by a seizure. No other music, though, had this effect. She had loved the Neapolitan songs, which reminded her of her childhood. "The old songs," she said, "they were always in the family. They always put them on. She found them very romantic, emotional. They had a meaning." But now that they triggered her seizures, she began to dread them. She became particularly apprehensive about weddings, coming as she did from a large Sicilian family, because such songs were always played at celebrations and family gatherings. "If the band started playing," Mrs. N. said, "I would run out. I had half a minute or less to get away." Though she sometimes had grand mal seizures in response to the songs, Mrs. N. more often experienced just a strange alteration of time and consciousness, in which she would have a feeling of reminiscence, specifically the feeling of being a teenager, or the reliving of scenes, some seemingly memories, others clearly fantasies, in which she was a teenager. She compared these to dreams, and said she would wake from them as from a dream, but a dream in which she retained some consciousness, though little control. She was able, for instance, to hear what people around her were saying, but unable to respond. That doubling of consciousness which Hewlings Jackson called mental diplopia. While most of her complex seizures referred to the past, she told me on one occasion, "It was the future I saw. I was up there, going to heaven. My grandmother opened up the gates of heaven. It's not time," she said, "and then I came too." Though Mrs. N could avoid Neapolitan music most of the time,